his, known as Antaradhana. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Antaradhana means that these living creatures can be perceived to be present, but they cannot be seen by vision. Om Agyanati Manandasya Agyananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Vilitam Jena Tazmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitana Manovistam Stapitam Jena Bhutare Svayam Rupa Karamayam Dharati Svaparantikam. There are some interesting points in this verse and purport, and in the whole chapter, for that matter. The conversation between Maitreya and Madhura consists in a large part of Maitreya explaining how Lord Brahma gave up different parts of his body that were, for various reasons, unsuitable, for various reasons not acceptable. And in one instance, he had to go to the Lord to take shelter because some of the entities that he created, that he generated, were coming to devour him. The principle of great devotees like Lord Brahma is that when they are in distressed condition, they turn to the Lord for help. Of course, they're always engaged in thinking of the Lord, and they don't always go to the Lord for help. It's a principle of material life that one goes to the Lord only for help. Prabhupada talked about how during wartime, the churches were filled during World War II in Europe with ladies who were praying to God for the return of their husbands, brothers, sons and fathers. And when the war ended, the churches were empty again, whether they came back or they didn't come back. So that's a principle of material life. Principle is to pray when there's difficulty, and when there's no difficulty, to sort of think everything is okay and not worry about it. And another principle of material life is to think that when something bad happens to me, it's God's fault. He did all these terrible things to me. It's kind of a materialistic, atheistic mentality. And when something very good happens to me, it's due to my own talents and prowess and abilities. So Lord Brahma, at the request of the Supreme Lord, had to sometimes give up different bodies. Sridhar Swami mentions that these are not necessarily bodies as we know them as a body, but a kind of a mentality, giving up a certain mindset. And that's part of the devotional process. It's important to remember that we are constantly giving up certain mentalities, certain things that we have come to accept as being true, which is actually part of the surrendering process. By devotional service, by entering into pure devotional service and entering into the surrendering process, we have to often give up things that we think are valuable. And sometimes we have to even give up things that are very dear to us. That's part of the surrendering process. It's accepting things which are favorable and giving up things which are unfavorable to Krishna consciousness. So there's a negative and a positive. Sometimes we have to give things up which we are very much attached to. And that's a sign, actually, of devotion. In one sense, the whole Bhagavad Gita could be said to be Krishna working on Arjuna to try to get him to become angry, because he was, as a very saintly person, didn't want to engage in this ghastly warfare and didn't want to see the relatives and friends on the other side killed, didn't want to see anyone harmed. So for the whole of Bhagavad Gita, in one way, in one sense of looking at it, we can say that Arjuna had to give up this mentality of wanting to be a pacifist or wanting to engage in nonviolence. So the whole thing was how to surrender, how to give up a certain mentality to please the Lord. That's part of devotional service, giving up. I think it was Emerson, one of the American writers, who said something to the effect that the only gift is a portion of thyself. Give up something that's very, very dear. That's really giving. So in devotional circles, this is even more so, more the case, because to give everything is the ultimate goal of Krishna consciousness, to give myself everything that I own, everything that is most dear to me. There was a end of the year kind of Sankirtan celebration class in Boston once that I went to, and Niranjan Maharaj was talking about all the devotees who had done very well, and he wanted to give out, he was giving out awards, and to the devotee who was the top distributor, who had the highest number of books distributed, who was undergoing the most austerities and penances, getting up earliest and working the hardest. He wanted to give him something. So he gave him one of his little tape recorders, which he used all the time, and he listened to before he went to bed at night, and he carried it with him everywhere. And he said, he told the class that this was the thing that he was his, the only, he didn't have very many things as a sannyasi, but the thing that he liked the most was his tape recorder. So he gave it to the devotee. It was an official kind of an award, a gift that he gave him. So I remember that because it was a, it was actually a very dear thing to him. It was a gift from the heart, and it was a symbol of giving something up, which was very prominently important, very dear to him. The Lord Brahma, in creating, in being a representative of the Supreme Lord, and having to do so many things to create a whole universe, and to not only create it, but to create it the way it was before, with all the same names and forms, was not a very easy task. But he always remembered that he was being empowered by the Lord to do these things. He never thought that I'm doing this by my own great talent, by my own prowess, by my own abilities. He always remembered that I'm doing this by the Lord's mercy. So if he had to do something that was difficult, or he had to give up something, he immediately did it. If the Lord asked him to give up his mentality, he immediately did it without question. So this is a symbol or a way of looking at how surrender takes place, that we have to give up so many things that are dear to us, sometimes the things that are very, very dear and the most dear to us. That is what Krishna is waiting for, that we have no other desire than to serve him. And that's actually what pure devotional service is. So here Lord Brahma is bestowing one of his talents, that of antardana, or invisibility. It's one of the mystical features of the Supreme Lord. Of course, Krishna is the Yogeshwar. He's the master of all mystics, and he possesses all these abilities. But particular higher than human beings possess, like the Siddhas and the Vidyadharas and others, possess these abilities to become invisible. And antardana is kind of an interesting word. When we say anta, it usually means the end of something. And dana is sometimes translated as property, possessions, paraphernalia, or wealth. So to say it means disappearance or invisibility means the end of visibility or property or wealth. It's sometimes, I think there was some yogi, I can't remember who it was, but was teaching a course whereby people could become invisible. There was a kind of a method of doing certain things that you could do. You could gain certain mystic siddhis, like flying and so on. And one of them was invisibility. People thought, and this was actually being taught at some point, that you could become invisible. People like to do it, and it's usually not the province of a human being to become invisible, but it's very difficult. There was one son of Prithu. His name was Vijitasya, and he was very, very astute and very renounced. In fact, when he became king, he didn't want to engage in punishing criminals or administering justice or just administering society. He retired at a very young age because he was very attached to Krishna in pure devotional service. So, as is narrated by Prabhupada in the fourth canto, he saw Indra stealing a horse from one of the great yajnas that Maharaj Prithu was conducting. And due to his particular qualities and due to his understanding that Indra was actually a devotee of the Lord, he didn't say anything. He didn't oppose him. He didn't fight him, which ordinarily would be done to see a horse stolen from your father's sacrifice. It was from the sacrificial arena. So Indra kind of took pity on him, or gave him some special mercy, so to speak. And he was given the title of Maharaj Antardana, and given this mystic power of being able to be invisible. And he's known, he's narrated, he had some sons. Pabamana was one of them, Shuchi was one of them. And they also ascended to the throne eventually. But he had this particular ability. It was a mystic siddhi that Indra and many of the higher demigods have. And he could attain the position of invisibility, Maharaj Antardana. His sons were the fire gods, as I remember, and they also had this quality of invisibility. They could disappear and appear as they like. And I think we read about Hiranyakashipu when the battle was taking place with Nisringadev. Sometimes he would manifest invisibility, would appear in one place and disappear, and he would appear in one place and disappear and then appear in another place to try to trick the Lord. So beings on higher planets have these very special abilities of invisibility. And there was a weapon, too, that I think Arjuna was given by I believe it was Kubera. It was an Antardhana chakra or something like that, which was either created invisibility or was an invisible weapon. So at various times in warfare, invisibility is considered to be a great asset. If one can disappear, one can have an invisible weapon, and it's a great power. Many people would like to manifest this power at will when they want to, sometimes when they're ashamed of themselves. Once, when I was before Prabhupada and being chastised, I wished that I could have manifested this quality. Or there's one called the Nima Siddhi, where you can become very small and disappear into the size of something that could go into a rock or a stone. So, sometimes these things are considered to be, like invisibility and other mystic powers, they're considered to be spiritual or something that like a miracle, you might say. There was an image, I think it was around about 1917 in Portugal, where this Lady Fatima appeared, and it was recorded, and many people saw it, and it's considered one of the great Christian miracles that people still write about. And anyone who does kind of a mystic siddhi, like I think people go to Lourdes, don't they, to get cured from varicose veins or something? These are considered kind of miraculous events. The different types of siddhis or miracles, they're also described in the Nectar of Devotion and other places. Prabhupada writes about them. There's the Nima Siddhi, there's Lagima Siddhi, Mahima Siddhi, Prapti Siddhi, Prakamya, Ishita, Vashishta, Kama Vasayita. There's 8 different siddhis that people can obtain, and he writes about them. On the higher planetary systems, too, they're very widely held and practiced. So one of them is to make oneself very small. And people, this kind of comes under the category of a miracle. There are certain yogis that still, to this day, they can sort of buckle themselves up in straitjackets. And I think Houdini was, maybe he was a yogi or something, managed to get out of the straitjacket. And this is a Nima Siddhi where they can make themselves very small. Then there's another mystic siddhi. The Vidyardharas have it. The siddhis, charanas, they can fly. They can make themselves very light. One of the miracles we read about is walking on water that Jesus Christ supposedly did and others can do. It's by becoming very light, or the yogis on magic carpets, flying in the air. It's a mystic siddhi. Now, Prabhupada points out that these kinds of so-called miracles are actually things that great yogis can obtain by practice. And when we think about what it takes to get one airplane up in the air, it's a very strenuous endeavor. It requires a lot of labor. Many, many people are working thousands of hours, and huge amounts of money are spent just to get one big airplane up in the air flying. And it's very noisy. It shakes. It makes a lot of people feel uncomfortable when it bounces around up in the air. But it's a power. It's a kind of mystic power, you might say. And Prabhupada points out in the Nectar of Devotion that these mystic siddhis are kind of a material things. They're material powers. Just like people have learned to fly in airplanes or make airplanes, the yogis could concentrate for a very, very long time, especially in past ages, and they could develop these powers by the force of their meditation. And they could fly in the sky. Or they could manifest themselves in more than one place at a time. They could, now people are trying to do that in modern science. They're cloning, they're creating holograms, they're doing different things to make it appear that they can be in many different places at different times. There's the CD of Prapti, which is acquisition, another one of the powers. By the way, all of the residents of the Siddha planets, the Siddhas, they have all of these powers. And it's understood that they can manifest them any time that they want. So this Prapti Siddhi Prabhupada talked about once in terms of a yogi who visited his home, And he said that that he produced some pomegranates that he presumably got from Kabul in Afghanistan. And there's a city of a property of acquisition of, you know, sort of being able to reach over a distance of thousands of miles. It's not exactly reaching in the way we understand that we're, you know, reaching, but it happens. It happens by mystic power. So we went into the room and saw this whole cluster of pomegranates that came off of a tree, presumably from Afghanistan. So that's one of the mystic cities. And then there's a mystic city whereby one can read the minds of other people. And sometimes we see that people have developed seemingly such powers. I read once that police detectives were using these people who had developed mystic powers or vision to hunt down and apprehend criminals. They could tell where they were, what they were doing, and they employed them in their service. That's been done several times because people somehow they develop, or they have, maybe they're born with these mystic powers. There's another mystic power where others can be controlled, where the mind of another person can be controlled. And I think there's one yogi who, at least we hear stories about, that produces gold and makes ash appear in his picture and supposedly appears in dreams to people, and maybe does, and controls people's minds. So that's another mystic city. And there's a mystic city by where one contravenes all the laws of nature. It seems that everything, that all the physical laws are being controverted by great, powerful people or yogis or whatever. But all these are material. One example of prapti siddhi that we see is that with our internet facilities, we can go, for example, into a library in another country or another part of the world, like Tokyo or Canberra or Sydney or someplace, and find something there, and then we can get it in our computer, in our modules, and then print it out and make a whole book. So we, in a sense, that's another kind of, again, there's people working day and night to perfect all of these things, to arrange for the universal resource locators and all the things that computers do, modems and modules. So you can, in a very short time, you can get something, a physical object almost, from another place very far away. That's prapti siddhi. So all of these mystic powers, they're considered miraculous. I talked to a gentleman the other day who's writing a book on miracles. And there's distinctions between, you know, what a miracle is, what a spiritual miracle is, so to speak, and what a material miracle is. In one way, a miracle is anything that we don't understand that's more powerful than we are. For example, the birds, they can fly in the air. They can, some birds, like vultures and birds of their species, their caliber, they have very good eyesight, and they can see something very, very far away. Especially vultures, they look for bleeding entities, and they're flying high in the sky, and they can sight it from a great distance. So they have powers that we don't have, and they're considered to be siddhis or shaktis. They have special shakti, a special power. Or a fish, they can swim in the water. Human beings can't do it. So for a human being, what a bird can do and what a fish can do is mystic power. So that's also a material thing. It's not unusual that such a power is there. The same thing with the power of the yogis. They have great powers to do things, but they're not spiritual powers. When Lord Chaitanya was present, we read that he hugged some palm trees and they were liberated. And there's a picture there in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita of the trees disappearing. He also made a tree grow when he threw a mango seed, and all of a sudden it grew. And everyone just had one mango and they felt very satisfied. So these kinds of miracles are spiritual miracles. They're not dependent on developing a mystic power. Or when Krishna, when he manifested himself, when he 16,100 forms, that's something no yogi can do. And Narada was astonished when he saw that he was doing something completely different in each house. He was playing with his children in one house, he was sporting with his wife in another house, he was sleeping in another house. So even though yogis can divide themselves into many portions, they're still doing the same thing, and they can only go up to 8 or 9 times. But Krishna did thousands of times. So these kinds of miracles are spiritual miracles. And when Haridas Thakur was caned in all the 21 marketplaces, he wanted his tormentors not to be tormented or killed. They told him that if you come back alive, we're going to be slain by our cruel taskmaster. So he feigned death and slid into the Ganga, and they thought he was dead. So this is just another kind of spiritual miracle. He was doing this because he was a pure devotee. He was greatly empowered by the Lord. And of course, it's a spiritual miracle that Prabhupada transformed so many people into devotees. That's sometimes called a spiritual miracle. Once, there's a story we hear that Prabhupada was on a train somewhere and in India, and some devotees were there, some Western devotees, and a gentleman was sitting across the seat opposite him and asked him, just some fellow traveler, if he could do any miracles, because that's kind of what one expects of so-called godmen in India. You know, spiritual masters are supposed to do something miraculous, let's make something float or disappear or whatever. So without missing a beat, Prabhupada said, this is my miracle, and he gestured to the white devotees, to the Europeans and the Americans. This is my miracle. And they're shaved up, they're wearing tilak, they're Vaishnavas. So that kind of impressed him that, yeah, this is a real miracle. There was another miracle story. There was a man who came to, when we had the temple in Berry Place, he was delivering mail. His name was Bhadresha, Mr. Bhadresha. He was kind of an elderly man in his 50s or 60s. And he just saw the sign Radha Krishna Temple, and he never knew anything about the devotees. He walked in and saw the deities, and he immediately offered his dandabhats. He was from South India. And he was so impressed that he decided to write a letter to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada liked the letter so much that he had it printed in Bhakti Godhead magazine. And basically, it said that you have performed the greatest miracle. Use the word miracle. You have transformed beastly humans into godly saints. And Prabhupada printed that, liked that very much. So that's a kind of a spiritual miracle that we're here today, having been what we were, and that the process goes on. Sometimes I say to people, they want to know how is Krishna consciousness going on. And once it was in 1971, I took one gentleman to meet Srila Prabhupada, and he had decided, he was about 24 years old, and he was the personal assistant to one of the Rothschilds, Cecil and Rothschild, and he studied international law and had a bunch of degrees in international finance, and he was going to retire at age 30. That was his plan. I don't know if he did. But he interviewed the devotees, he talked to them and just tried to get some understanding about where they were at and where they were coming from. And then he went to see Prabhupada. He explained to Prabhupada that the way that the Krishna consciousness movement was expanding, and it had so many centers and so many devotees. He said that it defied all the things that he studied, all the material laws of finance and administration and legalities. And later on I talked to him, and he said, yeah, it's really amazing how it has happened. And Prabhupada was very pleased to hear that someone realized that Krishna consciousness wasn't growing by the ordinary means. There was something different about it. So this is also a great miracle, that Krishna consciousness is growing at the rate it's growing, that it's spreading at the rate it's spreading. It's not happening. People that study how things work in the material world are often amazed that Krishna consciousness has gone so far in such a short time. So that's kind of a spiritual miracle. Sometimes the siddhas, even the charanas and the vidyadharas, because they're involved with demonic forces, they become adversaries to the Supreme Lord. It's mentioned in the fourth canto that if they follow the daityas and the danava, they can become influenced, and the yakshas as well. So these kinds of perfections are again, they're not really spiritual perfections. They're temporary. They're not complete. They're partial. And again, they're not spiritual. So even though they may appear to us to be very miraculous and very unusual, they're not really in the realm of pure devotional service. In fact, when all the demigods were present at the time of the annihilation of Aranyakashipu and Lord Nisringadev came, they were very afraid to approach Lord Nisringadev because they'd never seen the Lord in such a fierce form, even though they had all kinds of powers, mystic powers. So they chose to ask Prahlad to request him as the Nityasiddha, the pure devotee, to come before the Lord and pacify him, to cool him down. because they didn't feel that they were capable of acting upon the level of pure devotional service. So there are different types of siddhas, and they're mentioned. Prabhupada writes about them, and they're mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a sadhana siddha, there's a kripa siddha, there's a nitya siddha. Sadhana siddha is, of course, there are different types of siddhas too. There's siddhas that have attained the eight material perfections and live in the higher planetary systems. And there's siddhas that are trying to perfect devotional service. So these three types of siddhas who are discussed are sadhana siddha, which means one who attains perfection by following Adi Bhakti very resolutely, very strictly. Sadhana Bhakti, very good sadhana, we call it. And gradually, by following these principles, chanting 16 rounds, following four principles, of coming before the deity, reading Srimad Bhagavatam, serving the devotees and the spiritual master, spreading Krishna consciousness, reading Srimad Bhagavatam, one comes to point of perfection. There's another type of perfection that is sometimes called causeless mercy or kripa siddhi, where the Lord just somehow or other bestows mercy on someone who maybe hasn't even practiced sadhana or his newly acquired devotional service and gets liberated or gets the special mercy of the Lord. Sometimes we see that happen within our midst. A devotee in a very short time becomes very elevated. And sometimes, like Shivananda Sena's dog, the Lord gives special mercy to some persons that couldn't possibly understand the intricacies of the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. They get kripa siddhi, they get special mercy from the Lord. Prabhupada likened that once to someone getting an honorary degree. May not have gone through all the courses and passed all the examinations, but got an honorary doctorate, some kind of a degree. And then Nitya Siddha is a person who has perfection from the very beginning. Prahlad Maharaj is in that category of a Nitya Siddha, someone who is eternally liberated. There was one time when I first came to England, there was some controversy brewing amongst the devotees here as to where Prabhupada fitted in. Whether because we heard about he had a life before, we heard that he had children, that he was managed a pharmaceutical factory and had so many other lives. So was he a Nitya Siddha, was he a Kripa Siddha, was he a Sadhana Siddha? So one of us wrote a letter. I think I was deputed to write the letter, had to do the dirty work, and asked Prabhupada how we're supposed to understand who he is. So he wrote this very interesting letter back, and he said that he was talking about three different types of siddhas. There's the sadhana kripa and nitya siddha. And in it he said that when one becomes a siddha in spiritual terms, that is, one becomes a perfectly fixed person on the lotus feet of the Lord and considers liberation to attain to the lotus feet of Radha and Krishna in the spiritual world, then it's really irrelevant how one got to that position, whether one came through practice, whether one got special mercy, or whether one was eternally liberated. And he gave a metaphor of the rivers. The rivers flow down into the ocean. One ocean may be fed by hundreds and hundreds of rivers. He said, once the ocean is the ocean, you take water out of the ocean, it's always the same. It's the same kind of water, the same chemical composition. And there's no real consideration about this river, that river, what country it came from, or how it flowed in, but it's the ocean. So that was the metaphor he used to describe that once there is siddha, perfection in Krishna consciousness, it's really doesn't matter how it came, whether it's by nitya, whether it's by siddha, whether it's by sadhana, whether it's by kripa. So that was very, very insightful. And then he went on to say some other things. He quoted the verse from the Bhagavad Gita, Mamai Vamso Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana Manashtani Nindranani Pakritistani Karshati. That everyone, according to that verse, is part and parcel of Krishna, every living entity, every human, every non-human. So in one sense, he said that everyone is Nitya Siddha because everyone is part and parcel of Krishna. And then he went on to say that, and I think in a very similar kind of letter he wrote to Sulayan Sthumal Krishna Maharaj, that there never was a time when I did not think of Krishna. From my earliest childhood, I was thinking of Krishna, I was thinking of Rath Yatra, I had little images of Krishna, I had Krishna deities, Krishna thoughts in my mind. So that was an indication, actually, that he's a Nitya Siddha. But it was very interesting. Also, we find that we celebrate in Vaishnava tradition the Tirubhava more than the Anubhavas, the disappearance of the great Vaishnavas. And there are so many, many, many samadhis in Vrindavan, many holy days in which we worship these great souls. And generally we find that we're worshiping them on the basis of their accomplishments. When they were born, we didn't necessarily know what was going to transpire, what they were going to be. But by their accomplishments, they achieved many great things. They wrote great literatures, or they unearthed great temples. They had specific perspectives and writings that were very helpful to our developing Krishna consciousness. And so they're considered great devotees by virtue of what they did. So this is a type of siddha that comes later on. It's more like a sadhana siddha. So there are different types of siddhas and different types of realizations that we consider important. These people on the higher planetary systems have a human-like form generally, just like Krishna does. And I think it's said in the Bible that man is created in the image of God. Well, these are all different types of human forms. And some are more powerful than others. And sometimes they're visible, sometimes they're not visible. One of the qualities of the siddhas is that they can fly. They can go from not just one tree to another, one house, but they can go in outer space from one planet to another. So this is considered to be mystic power, because to go to any other planet is, in fact, it's virtually impossible. Of course, they say they went to here and there. Prabhupada disputes that. But they have to have spacesuits, they have to have rocket ships, and they spend so much money. This is a little diversion, but there's a video that someone ordered for me, which purports that the human beings never went to the moon. I'll just mention it briefly, because it's very interesting. This investigator went to the places where the actual modules are of the space capsules, and he demonstrates that it would be impossible to get in and out of those vehicles in spacesuits. And then he analyzes many of the films and photographs that were being available publicly by the NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, by the United States. He analyzes them very carefully, showing the trajectory of the dust that was thrown up by the space vehicle, and it was impossible to do in that kind of gravity. And in the film, they come to one place. There's a certain configuration of rocks, and they go off about 20 miles in their lunar vehicle to another place. And in the film, the same exact configuration of rocks is there. The same rocks are there. And it becomes very obvious that they're in the same place they started out from. So anyway, it's kind of interesting to note that it's almost a kind of proof of what Prabhupada was saying, that they didn't really go there. But the siddhas, they can go into these outer space without any kind of vehicles, without any kind of spacesuits. They just go. They don't have to worry about how they're going to breathe. They're able to go. So these are powers that some of the living entities have. And it's listed in the Bhagavatam, the order of powers that people have. When I say people, it means that those who have a human form of life. So the humans are on one level. And then superior to humans are ghosts. Superior to ghosts are the siddhas. First the Gandharvas, then the siddhas, then the Kinaras, then the Asuras, then the demigods, Indra, Daksha, Shiva, Brahma, Narada, like that. It's listed. Sorry, Shiva, Brahma, Narada, and then Brahma. They have, one is superior to the other. They have superior powers to act. So human being is also a very limited in its ability to have powers to fly, powers to see other people's minds, to control other people. Very, very limited. And Vidyadharas are sometimes called, they're very expert in singing. They're very beautiful. And they're called, in one place Prabhupada refers to them as semi-demigods. Semi-demi. They're like demigods, but they're not quite like demigods. So they also have great power. And I think it was Chitraketu who became king of the Vidyadharas at one point. Yeah, he's mentioned there. And that was just a very short time. He was their king and head of the Vidyadharas for a few days, it's mentioned, and then he went back to the spiritual world. So sometimes these are kind of the celestial species of human beings, and people attain them and for a time, and then it's possible to move from that point on to go back to Godhead. But a person engaged in pure devotional service, who is a different type of siddha, manushyanam sahasreshu kashchanyatati siddhaye, that type of siddha is very difficult to obtain. Yatatam api siddhanam kashchan mam vedhi tatvatat. It's explained in the Bhagavad Gita that out of many who are in the category of being perfect, who are, in other words, candidates for pure devotional service, only one in thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, millions, attains pure devotional service. So this kind of siddha is the kind of the category of siddha that a devotee aspires to obtain. In other words, one becomes perfect not by mystic power or by controlling nature or controlling other people, but by becoming a pure devotional servant, by becoming a servant of the master of all mystics, of all siddhas. So in different lectures Prabhupada was talking about, said in one, I think it was in Delhi, 1973, he said, that kind of siddha is not recommended. He was talking about the types of powers that can be acquired by human beings. So that type of siddha is not recommended. We want spiritual identity and want to work for that spiritual identity. Krishna is the embodiment of all these mystic powers. Sometimes he became heavy. He caused, Trinivarta to fall to the ground. Sometimes he disappeared. Sometimes he made himself very small. But instead of trying to be like Krishna, the devotee wants to serve Krishna, wants to be Krishna's servant or confidant. And therefore, his type of perfection is perfecting his selflessness, perfecting devotional qualities. And in a way, it's just the opposite of trying to acquire power, mystic city. It's being the servant of the powerful. And in one sense, the whole problem that we face is thinking that we should have powers, that we should be more powerful, that we should be more in control. But rather, we want to release our devotional sentiments and release our energies. And in this way, Krishna empowers, Prabhupada uses that word a lot, empowers. Empowered Lord Chaitanya, empowered all of his followers. He empowers all of his devotees. That empowerment is not empowerment to control others, but to bring others to the point of surrender, to bring others to the point of wanting to serve that master of all mystic power. That's real empowerment, and that's the kind of empowerment that Prabhupada writes about. In one lecture he said, siddha means nirbandha krishna sambandha yukta vairagya uchite. He said, that is really siddha. The real mystic power, in other words, is to engage everything which is ordinarily ugra karma, or antithetical to the principles of Krishna consciousness, to engage those things in the service of Krishna. That is real siddha. That's becoming a real siddhi. You can use something, and that's a principle of Bhagavad Gita also. Yagyartat karma nonyatra lokoyam karma bandhanaha tadartam karma kunteya mukta sangha samachara. The very things that keep us bound in this material world can be used for expanding Krishna consciousness, the very things. So this is the mystic power. It's a transforming process. It's the real miracle. It's the real siddhi. When Prabhupada was in his room once in 1976, he was talking about the microphone, and he said that by speaking Krishna Katha into this microphone, the manufacturer is being benefited. So these are very difficult things to understand, that these are mystic siddhis. How they actually happen, we don't know, but they do. Somehow they happen. So this process of Yukta Vairagya, of transforming matter into spirit, the iron in the proverbial fire becomes like fire. But how material things become spiritualized, Prabhupada would say that is the real mystic city. That's the thing we're aspiring for, to learn how to engage everything, even our very materialistic mentalities and our powers, in the service of Krishna. That is the real siddha, so to speak. So, of the many types of siddhas, there's the kripa siddha, the sadhana siddha, the nitya siddha. Prabhupada emphasized this particular type of devotion. We can become empowered, we can empower others, and we can use everything in Krishna's service. And that would be the perfection of perfection. Siddha means perfection, perfect person. And so it has that materialistic side, that you can attain powers, and then you can attain pure devotional service and be a perfect person. So I'll stop there. I think. Is there any comments or questions? Mantra 2. Spirit guides. Mm-hmm. All the time, I keep hearing them. It's very fashionable to use the word spiritual nowadays. I suppose it was fashionable before, but it's used to mean something that's attractive or beautiful or wonderful. When Prabhupada went to Stanford University, around 1967, and everybody just danced next to see, they're having such a good time. One of the students that was in a really mystical sort of happy trance came up to one of the devotees and said, "Sex is so spiritual." That anything people enjoy or think is different or unexplainable is often goes under the category of spiritual. And there's books written about it. And, you know, in a way, maybe it's good. Maybe there's some kind of a so-called spiritual revival. But usually it's based on psychological principles of happiness. And it's not really based on giving. It's based on, being kind of in control. It's not that it's all bad or all wrong, because sometimes the people who are involved in these things become devotees, and it's a kind of a bridging way for some people to come to Krishna consciousness. But for the most part, the idea of being in touch with people who have departed, that's generally not actually the case. We were talking with what's that dentist's name? I can't remember. Dr. Wilder, Leonard Wilder, and he did a lot of hypnosis, and with devotees to try to determine, if we could really go into past lives and things like that. And his conclusion, at least to me, he said this, and I think this is the conclusion of many other people, was that it's almost impossible to really connect with a past life. You can get a sense of what the person was like, that they're devotional, that they believed in God and things like that, but to actually determine what was really going on, and it's very difficult. And most of the so-called reincarnation hypnotist types of people that make people think that they knew they were Marie Antoinette in their past life, or Henry VIII, or whatever, many things usually are not actually doing it. I mean, there are cases. There's a few cases, but from the research I've done, it's less than 1% of cases where one can actually connect with something real that really happened. And my understanding of connecting with departed spirits, and of course there's Sanjeevan, and there's, we hear that there's so many mystic powers to bring people back from the dead, that those kinds of powers existed, and powers to communicate with entities that weren't embodied. And I'm sure that there's some people that know how to do that. Nowadays, not very many. But it's kind of a landmine, minefield in a way, that you start getting involved in all of these New Age ideas about channeling and connecting with past beings, that it becomes kind of a phenomenon in itself, with a life of its own. And in most cases, it's not really a spiritual phenomenon. And I think, this is my perspective on it, that it's not real. That we're not really connecting with people that we're imagining it. I did some research about reincarnation and found that in most of the people that had visitations, mystic visitations, or went under hypnosis and had thoughts and said what they did in the past lives, were never verifiable, and they weren't real things. They weren't actually able to go into past lives. They could go back in their own life, but they couldn't go into a past life and in great in any serious detail. I mean, like I said, there's a few exceptions, but they were very exceptional cases. Those are the ones we probably hear about a bit as devotees. But It's a big business, and it's we shouldn't be fooled into the fact that people are making a huge amount of money by so-called regressing people into past lives and thinking that that's the cause of this, that, and the other thing. So it's a bit of a hucksterism. Something I think we should be very wary of. I think Deva Amrita Maharaj wrote some books about, and he preaches about all this, the kind of New Age mentalities, New Age phenomena, New Age initiatives that go on, and talks about them in terms of Krishna consciousness. I think he's even maybe written a book about it. But a lot of this needs a proper exposure. It needs to be exposed for what it is. It's not what many people think it is. That's just my thoughts on it. Maybe you want to add something. Yeah, so maybe that's another perspective on it. Actually, I think Deva Amrita and maybe Bhaktivedanta Maharaj also have found that people who are into this kind of phenomenon also make very good candidates. They tend to be good candidates for devotional service. That's one of the... Yeah, I read Alien Identities. But I think... except for Fatima and a few others, most of the things that we're reading in Alien Identities are about people who have mystic and Shakti and Siddha powers, but they're not spiritual powers. And even the Fatima thing is a little questionable. But those, I mean, that's a very good exposition of powers, that, you know, invisibility and all that sort of thing. But I think he doesn't draw the conclusion that these are spiritual. I mean, he doesn't. It's interesting. In a way, it's a step, because just to think that there's something beyond what we can measure in physics as being real is a step to devotional service. So I think it is definitely a step. It can be a positive step. I hope I'm not sounding too negative about it. But I think as devotees, we have to be careful that we're not taken in by this sort of thing, or fooled by it. Anything else? Yes, yes.
Could you explain these kind of posts to the superior, considering that, well, I understand that if we and leave our body and it's also people stay at
home. Yeah. The way in which it's phrased is they're superior. Now, that can have a lot of meanings, and it doesn't mean superior in every way and not inferior in other ways. And as you intimate, if a person is commit suicide or there's certain violent circumstances, one can become disembodied. And that's considered to be a very unhappy state. In fact, there are many ceremonies, like we were reading about yesterday, Shraddha ceremony and others, to liberate entities from that condition, because it's not a very happy condition. But really what's being talked about here in superiority is abilities and empowerments and certain mystic powers. It's kind of really more about power. And it's that ghosts can inhabit bodies, they can travel in space, they can do all the things that we're limited to, that we have a body that we have to be limited to. And very powerful ghosts can move objects and do all sorts of things, can become different people. So it's not spiritual in that sense. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're in a better state or a happier state of mind. A ghost is generally always trying to get into a body, so can get out of that state of being disembodied and gratify the senses. It's kind of like the tiger, you know, it's always trying to eat, it's always hungry. A ghost is always trying to get a body, but has special powers. Yes? What the relation between the two is? Yes. Yeah, I mean, everything, in one sense, everyone is a kripasiddha, because we can't have perfection unless we get the mercy of the Lord, because one of the symptoms of surrender is to always be dependent on the mercy of the Lord. Man proposes, God disposes, it is said. We can do everything right, but ultimately Krishna can withhold pure devotional service. Generally, if we follow the principles of sadhana bhakti, we become purified. Krishna feels very inclined to bestow his mercy. That's written in Srimad Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita and all of our scriptures, that one who becomes a devotee, Krishna identifies with that person, and that person is very dear to Krishna. That is like the heart of the Supreme Lord himself. So he's very disposed to his devotees and to give them liberation. But ultimately, because his mercy is causeless, his sweet will is always completely unknowable to us, so we don't know. And then he can extend his mercy upon even someone who is disobedient and recalcitrant and not following properly, or maybe at the last moment somehow. So that also is Krishna's mercy. So ultimately everything is, yes, it's Krishna's mercy. But we can get Krishna's, we can earn Krishna's mercy by practicing proper sadhana. And at the same time, we leave everything up to Krishna. You can do with me as you like, as it is said in the Shikrastaka. Whether you crush me by your embrace or make me brokenhearted by not being present before me, you're still completely free to do anything and everything. You're always my worshipful Lord. So we, as devotees, we have that attitude, that whatever Krishna wants to do, we'll do. But he's very inclined to his devotees. Well, Narada Muni is sometimes cited as one who came to that point by having a past life and having doing things that weren't appropriate. He was a Gandharva, then he became a Gandharva, then he became Narada Muni. So there are many examples of people who attained perfection by following the principles of sadhana bhakti. The Goswamis, I mean, even though they're mentioned as being incarnations of gopis and manjaris, they have a past, and they began to engage in pure devotional service. They were associating with Muslims, and there were many, many others in our line of succession who we celebrate, who perfect devotional service by practice. They became very pure. They began to chant. They began to follow all the regulative principles. So many examples. Almost all the appearance days and disappearance days we celebrate of great souls. The many devotees that are mentioned in Chaitanya Chaitamrita are examples of those who attain perfection by following regulated principles. So there are many, many, many. So it's 8:45. I think we'll end the class now. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jaya. Srila Prabhupada ki jaya.